I grabbed the walker just as another round struck the table, sending splinters into the air, and I whirled in time to see the bartender attempting to take better aim. Lucian fired and hit the man in the upper right-hand quarter of his chest, spinning him around and throwing him into the bar back with a crescendo of shattered glass before he slid to the floor. Figuring I could count on the old sheriff to check his shot, I shoved the big Colt in my belt at my back and kneeled down by the wounded detective. The round had shattered his jaw but had exited through the other side. He was still clutching at the ghastly wound as I yanked a bandana from my back pocket and attempted to slide it beneath his fingers, the blood going everywhere. He tried to speak as his eyes glazed over, and with the amount of blood in his mouth I was afraid he might choke. "Don't try and talk. It didn't get your throat, so you're not going to bleed to death." I held the material against the side of his face. "Hold on to this. He got your jaw. Keep your mouth shut and just lay there and try to not go into shock." He blinked once, and then his eyes sharpened, followed by a curt nod. I yanked my head up to look at Lucian, who had crossed to check on the man behind the bar. "Dead?" The old sheriff nodded. "Or doing a damn fine impersonation of it. How's a New Mexican?" "Alive, but he's going to need some dental work. Take some of these bar towels and go over there and sit with him and keep him from going into shock. I'll get on the radio in his car and call in the troops." I could have used a cell phone or the phone in the bar, but I figured by the time they got me patched through a 911 operator, I might as well have gone out and gotten on the detective's two-way. The snow which had covered the vehicles had just about stopped, but now there was a ground fog that obscured the landscape. Whiteout, like South Dakota. Well, hell. I stood there for a moment, feeling something out there in the blank, white parking lot, almost as if something was watching me. Ignoring the feeling, I walked over to the detective's cruiser and yanked the door open. It sounded like a glacier cleaving. I threw myself inside and turned the key, thanking the heavens that Harvey, like most Wyoming residents, had left it in the ignition. I punched the mic and reported shots fired and an officer down at the 16-tons bar, whereupon the dispatcher asked me the location. "It's in Arosa, about 15 miles east of Gillette." So much for speeding the process. Static. "There are a number of communication towers down in that area, and with the weather conditions and the amount of responses we've got out, it might be a while before they get there." I keyed the mic again. "The officer is stabilized, but in pretty rough condition, so get us an EMT van and a couple of units as quickly as you can." Static. "And who is this again?" "Sheriff Walt Longmire of Absaroka County." Static. "So you're not Campbell County personnel?" "No, but Detective Richard Harvey is, and he's lying on the floor bleeding, hopefully not to death." I threw the mic against the dash and clumsily cut the ignition, figuring if I was hauling the detective into town, I was going to do it in my truck, which had four-wheel drive. Climbing out of the cruiser, I pushed at the bandage on my neck, where I'd irritated it, and stood there in the fog, with the feeling of being watched overtaking me again. There was a breath of a breeze, and I looked across the parking lot, where the fog had parted like a curtain, and at the concrete-blocked building, and the American flag that flapped feebly against its own pole, attempting to get my attention. I stood there for a moment longer, and then charged into the bar. Lucian was with the detective and was holding the side of his face with the towels.
"Bartender's still dead, in case you were wondering."
Lucian wasn't the guy from the post office sitting on one of these stools before the shooting started. The old sheriff glanced around.
"The horse's ass with the ponytail?"
"Yep." He gave it a quick thought.
"He was there earlier, but I don't remember him being in the place when the bartender shot Harvey here."
He sighed.
"You think he ran out before, or when the shooting started?"
I stopped to pick up the detective's .357, undeterred by the bloody molar and chunk of jawbone lying beside it, and then moved toward the back door.
"I'm not sure, but I intend to find out." "What the hell do you want from me, then?"
I gestured toward the wounded man. "How's he doing?" Lucian looked down at the steady eyes peering up from the gory mess of a face.
"He was trying to talk, but I told him to shut the hell up and wrap those towels around his face along with a couple of sponges from the counter over there."
He looked up at me.
"You gotta hand it to these New Mexicans. They can bleed with the best of them."
I placed a hand on the door. "Help's on the way, but it may take a while with the ground fog out there. So collect as many teeth as you can and just try and keep him from bleeding to death."
"You going out there into the rain, sleet and snow and gloom of night?"
"Late afternoon," I nodded. "The postman's the only one who can still talk, and he's not here, and that speaks volumes."
"What do you want me to do when the troops arrive?"
I pushed the door open and stood there,
waves of cold and bad feelings enveloping my exposed flesh.
Find me.
I stepped out into the monochromatic landscape. The postman's tracks traced to the left around his doomed office, the divots partially filled in but still visible. You couldn't even see the road for the frozen fog, and the snow had started softly falling again. It was like walking into cotton batting, the flakes swallowing all sound. I went around the building, almost tripping, when I strapped my boots on one of the covered parking curbs, and looked down at the area where the postman had evidently paused to watch me as I'd called in backup. That must have been the feeling I'd had. It was possible that Rowan had just wanted to make himself scarce in a room full of flying bullets. But then why hadn't he returned? And why had he stood out here and studied me as I'd called in? I pulled the big Colt from the back of my pants and stuck it in my sling again, one gun possibly proving to not be enough. The footprints led to the rear of the post office, where the back door hung open about 8 inches. I glanced at the only vehicle parked behind the building. A battered CJ7 Jeep without a straight piece of sheet metal on it sat with a good 8 inches of snow on the hood. I thought about checking for the keys or pulling the coil wire, but figured the thing was derelict. I saddled up beside the back door of the building and gently swung it open with the barrel of the detective's .357. The storage room was empty. Stepping inside, I made a quick sweep of the area and then, dipping the Colt into the narrow aisleways and following the prints, worked my way down a couple of rows of 8-foot metal shelves. There was a basket half overturned on the floor, not unlike the one that the postman had given to me containing the collective mail of Yone Urecha, so I nudged it over the rest of the way. It was empty, except for a sticker that had rolled up and was half stuck to its side. I stooped down and plucked it from the basket and read the typed address, a label redirecting mail for Linda Schaffer, the clerk from Kmart, to a box at this post office. I stood and looked around at the mountains of paper ready to avalanche on me should I decide to start digging, and wished I had Dougherty with me. It was just as I'd had that thought that the cell phone in my pocket started buzzing, and I pulled the thing out and looked at it. Dougherty. I punched the button. Hey, troop, I was just thinking about you. There was no reply. Dougherty? There was still nothing. Evidently, the reception was good enough to allow a call to go through, but not enough to retain it. I glanced around the post office, finally spotting a phone on a nearby desk. I picked up the receiver, satisfied with the dial tone, and punched in Corbin's cell number. Hello? Dougherty, it's Walt Longmire. Yeah, I just called you. I know, the transponders down here are covered with ice and malfunctioning. Nothing is working. Did you find something? I've been going through those files and came across a transcription that wasn't in the computer. Somebody else he talked to. Who? A woman named Izzy. Does that ring any bells? A faint alarm went off somewhere in the periphery of my head, but nothing I could place. Izzy? Yeah, Izzy. Evidently, she was involved with the Dave Rowan guy in something that Holman seemed highly suspicious of. I looked around, aware that I was still pursuing a felon. Well, keep digging and get back to me. As I hung up, I could still hear his voice. How? Rowan had continued through a door into the commercial area and around a counter where 3 P.O. boxes hung open, one with the key still hanging from the lock. There were wet boot prints there that trailed across the tile-covered floor and out the front. As I pushed open the door into the silence of the outside, I saw that the tracks were much fresher and more defined, and that now there were two individuals walking. It looked as if they'd taken only one step out and then headed to the right, away from the bar toward the strip club and the scattered trailers belonging to the dancers. There was a thundering noise growing louder to my left as I headed east on the frontage road, and all I hoped was that it wasn't a plow coming up from behind preparing to dump a few tons of snow on top of me. The sound became more familiar as it grew louder, and I turned my head in time to see the billowing vortex of snow being swept along behind another Burlington Northern Santa Fe. As it is with mountains making their own weather, the mile-long train drew its own along with it, clearing the road and the surrounding area as it carried millions of dollars worth of not-so-hard fuel. The pair of prints passed the trailers and angled into Dirty Shirley's parking lot, making a beeline for the back door where I'd first seen the bouncer. I tried it, but it didn't budge, and then thought about shooting the lock as they do on TV shows like Steadfast Resolution. But in reality, all that ever does is mess up the lock and not open the door. Still thinking about that name, Izzy, I began the long trudge around the building and eventually got to the alcove that protected the front entrance. Where had I heard that before? I pulled on the door, it opened, and I eased it closed behind me. It was dark in the interior of the building, and I couldn't see much beyond some half-drawn heavy curtains that led toward an elevated area. There were a few illuminated liquor advertisements behind the bar that were reflected in the numerous mirrors on the black velvet walls. I stood there for a few seconds, letting my eyes adjust, and thought I might have seen something move. I watched the mirrors and finally saw the end of a baseball bat hovering in the blackness. Unsure from which direction it was reflecting, I figured I had to make a guess. Remembering that the bouncer had led with his right, I decided to move to the left and direct fire to the right, where he'd most likely be. As mistakes go, it was a doozy. He was on the left and caught me with the Louisville slugger. Luckily, it was a glancing blow, and I had dropped my head, but unluckily I tripped on the shag carpet and tumbled off onto the dance floor. When I hit the ground, the 357 clattered out of my hand and slid across the tile underneath the other platform. You know, you really should have left off on this one. Not only are you too old for this shit, but you're too dumb, too. He patted the wooden bat in the palm of his other hand with a continuous smack. Now I've got to beat you to death, and I was just getting to kind of like you. I rolled over and stared up at him. Where's the postman? Dave is taking care of business. He stopped at the step and took a few practice swings. That's what we're all doing, taking care of business. I pushed a little away and propped myself against a chair. And what part of the business are you in? He palmed the bat again. Right now, the tenderizing business. He stepped down. USC, huh? Yep. He raised the bat. Well, Trojan, say hello to the Fighting Irish. I pulled the Colt Walker from my sling and carefully aimed it at his face. Fight this! He stared at the massive barrel of the vintage firearm. I've never seen a human being shot with one of these cap-and-ball jobs, but I've heard they about half explode on contact. So not only do you get the primary wound, but bits and pieces of the ball scatter all over you. I could see him weighing his chances. But you won't have to worry about that, because before I take another hit with that bat, as my old boss used to say, I'll spray your brains out of the back of your head like a manure spreader. There was a tense moment, and then he lowered the bat onto his shoulder and sighed. I don't want to go to prison. I just wanted to get my knee fixed. It might be a little late for that. I pushed off the floor, keeping the walker on him. What's going on around here anyway? He reached a hand out, but I ignored it, and stood on my own, watching his muscles tense in his shoulders as he thought about swinging the bat again. I shoved the big Colt in his face. I'm getting the feeling that you just aren't trustworthy. I pulled the cuffs from my pocket, tossed them to him, and motioned toward the pole at the center of the stage. Hook yourself to that. He stepped back. No way, man. I lowered my aim at his good leg. Do it, or you're going to be rehabbing both of those knees. He dragged a chair from one of the tables onto the stage and did as I said, slumping into a seated position with his wrist attached to the chrome pole.
Happy?
Give me the bat. He did, and I sat at another table with the lumber in front of me. So, I'll ask the question again. What's going on?
My question exactly.
The voice that came from behind me was female, sort of, and was accompanied by the sound of a slide action being pulled back on a 9mm semi-automatic. I turned and was treated to the sight of the sister of the sheriff of Campbell County and proprietor of the establishment pointing a pistol at me.
Tommy!
She threw her purse and coat onto the bar and looked at the two of us.
What the hell is going on in here?
Thor was the first to speak.
Thank God you're here, Tommy. I caught this guy snooping around and hit him with the bat, but he got the jump on me and cuffed me to the pole.
I interrupted. Call your brother. I'm working on a case involving the missing women, your boyfriend, Dave, the recently deceased bartender of the 16 Tons,
and the mullet with the mouth cuffed to the pole here are all involved."
She looked disgusted, then considered him and then me again.
"Mister, I've done quite well in life, knowing what aspects of my business I need to involve my brother in and which ones I don't. Another thing I've fine-tuned is my ability to sniff out bullshit when it's being shoveled my way."
She came down, sat in the chair across the table from me, and then readdressed her aim to the bouncer.
"Now, Thor, you tell him everything he wants to know, or I'll shoot you myself."
The blonde kid pleaded,
"Tommy, you don't understand."
The 9mm went off, splintering a hole in the stage floor no more than a yard away from the kid's foot as he wrapped himself around the pole. I sat the walker on the table and cleared my nearest ear with the tip of a pinky.
"You mind telling me when you get ready to shoot that thing again?"
She casually lifted the semi-automatic and blasted another round in the stage a foot away from the kid's other sneaker, causing him to leap up, overturn his chair, and stand comically behind the chrome pole. She glanced at me.
"I might be shooting some more."
"Thanks for the warning."
"Think nothing of it."
She took out a pack of cigarettes and a lighter, torching up a menthol, and rested her elbow on the table in order to sight the pistol on Thor's private parts.
"You were saying?"
The kid was on the verge of crying.
"It wasn't my idea."
She puffed her cigarette as if her life depended on it.
"Comforting, seeing as how in the couple of years I've known you, I've never known you to have one. It was a postman, honest."
I watched as Tommy's hand tightened around the pistol.
"Dave."
"He always rings twice."
Figuring the kid was scared enough, I reached over and lowered Tommy's weapon.
"Tell me about Mr. Rowan, Curtis."
"It was his idea."
Thor relaxed and leaned against the pole.
"He gets these catalogs with women in them at the post office, and he figured he could go into the business himself, what with it closing and him losing his job anyway."
"Mail order brides?"
"Yeah, well, kind of."
"Kind of?"
He nodded.
"More like servants. We were all talking over at the bar one night, and he brought the subject up. We didn't know that he'd already done it twice with women from town, but we figured we had a supply of women that we could use from the club."
"You mean you abducted these women against their will and sold them?"
Yeah.
I sat there, thinking that the report from Tommy's pistol had affected my hearing.
"Slaves?"
"Sort of, yeah."
She raised the pistol and aimed again.
"Can I shoot him now?"
I pushed the 9mm away. "Not till we find out where the women are." I turned and gave the bouncer my most immediate and severe attention.
"At last count, there are three. Where are they?"
He mumbled the next part.
"All over. I'm shooting this little bastard on general principles."
I held the gun away. "Where are they?"
He shook his head as he spoke.
"One might be somewhere in Florida, maybe."
"Rowan has the list?"
He nodded.
"He knows everything."
"So where is he?"
"I don't know."
Tommy lifted the pistol again, and this time I didn't attempt to dissuade her, and Thor suddenly remembered the conversation.
"He came in here and told me you were going to kill us all and that I was supposed to stop you no matter what it took."
"Then he left?"
"Yeah."
I thought about it.
"There had to be a place where you kept the women before shipping them out or delivering them. Where was that?"
"We kept them sedated in the trailer."
"The one that burned down?"
"Yeah."
I stood.
"What about Yona Urecha?"
"Who?"
I gestured toward Tommy.
"Shoot him."
She did, this time missing a foot by inches.
"Your running partner, the Basque woman."
"The schoolhouse."
I stuffed the Colt Walker into my sling. "Over by the bar?"
"No, the old one back up the canyon road."
I walked to the stage and lifted the short curtain that trimmed the dancing area but couldn't see the 357. "There's a pistol that slid under there that belongs to the detective that's been working on this case. When the sheriff's department gets here to take Golden Boy into custody, tell them about it, would you?" She nodded.
"Will do. You headed for the schoolhouse?"
"I am."
"You can't see a damn thing out there."
She stubbed her cigarette out on the table.
"You want me to send the troops and my half-wit brother after you, or do you just want to shoot that asshole Dave and leave him for the coyotes?"
"It's tempting, but send them after me."
"Will do."
I straightened my hat and zipped up my coat with my good arm, careful of the bandage on my neck.
"Can I drive there?"
She and the bouncer looked at each other.
"I'll take that as a no."
It's just a dirt road and all rutted out. In weather like this, I think you better walk.
How far?
About a mile, she frowned. And I was going to marry that son of a bitch.
When I came out the back door of the strip club and looked across the field, I could see that the Jeep was gone. I could also see the revolving lights of the Campbell County Sheriff's car. I hustled across the parking lot and down the road, getting to the 16-tons bar in time to see the present sheriff of Campbell County and the retired sheriff of Absaroka loading the wounded investigator into the back seat.
"Where's the EMT van?"
Sandy turned and looked at me as they made Harvey as comfortable as possible, his head wrapped with so many bar towels it was starting to look like the top of a snowman. All he needed was some coal and a carrot.
"With this fog, you're lucky that radio call you put in with my dispatcher got through to me. I'll drive him over to the hospital and then come back."
He glanced past me toward the mail office next door.
"I understand we've got somebody who's gone postal?"
"From what I got from Curtis, the kid I handcuffed to a pole over at your sister's strip club, he, the dead bartender, and the postman are running some kind of white slavery ring."
He guffawed. "You've got to be kidding."
"I wish I were." I glanced at the hills behind the small town. "Supposedly they kept the women in the old one-room schoolhouse up in the hills out here." Sandy nodded.
"There's a road, but the fastest way to get there is to follow the railroad spur behind the school that deadheads about a mile down the canyon, and that way you can drive."
He pointed to a line of empty coal cars.
"They sometimes park the cars there before they roll them down to Black Diamond, where they fill them up. When you get to the end of the line, hop over the top of the hill, and the school will be right there."
I held a hand out. "Let me borrow your cuffs." He handed them to me, and I reached for my keys.
"There's a road beside the tracks?"
He nodded.
"A lot better one than that goat path on the ridge."
I started to move off, but Lucian caught my arm.
"What do you want me to do?"
I glanced at Sandy.
"Is this the only road out of town?" "In or out."
I turned back to the old sheriff, the man who had gotten me into this mess. "Stay here in case he decides to make a run for it. Take Harvey's car and set up out there on the entryway to the railroad crossing." I started off toward my truck.
"You see him, you stop him,"
Lucian called after me.
"Like I did the bartender?"
I called back over my shoulder.
"Or the coffee pot."
Chapter 14. There was a BNSF high rail truck sitting at the top of the deadhead, the kind that can run on railroad tracks when the gear is lowered, and I slowed down and stopped to yell out my window, "Any chance of you guys moving these cars in the near future?" He smiled. "You chasing the mailman? He go by here?"
"About 20 minutes ago."
I looked at the cars and at the narrow roadway on the side, clogged with snow. "Really, any chance of moving these damn things?" He pushed the hood back on his Carhartt, and I recognized the man I'd met at the 16 tons, Fry printed on a name patch.
"In about 45 minutes, we're going to move him out and fill him up."
He jerked a thumb over his shoulder.
"The mine is worried they're going to get snowed in, so they're going to take this spur train and attach it."
"No sooner, huh?"
He smiled.
"Not unless you want to hook that big V10 up and pull him yourself."
"Don't tempt me."
I rolled the window back up and decided that I didn't need the sling anymore. Putting the cumbersome thing off and stuffing it in my pocket, I carefully slid my arm into the sleeve of my coat. My neck was sore, but I could deal with that. I spun the wheel, negotiated my way around the coal cars, and began the slow and arduous task of drifting my way down the sloped road in an attempt not to slip off into the ditch or run into the train cars. There was a fresh set of tracks that rolled alongside in a straight line, a testament to the Jeep's more nimble design, but I kept turning into the slide and making progress. I glanced at the tops of the coal cars and could see that they were indeed empty. The only way to keep any kind of forward momentum was by staying on the gas, even though I was traveling about 30 miles an hour sideways to do so. Fortunately, when I got to the end of the line, there was a buttress of railroad ties and fill dirt, looking almost like a ramp, leading up to the last car and, more important, an open area where I could goose the truck and climb up out of the ditch to straddle a flat spot. I gunned the 3/4 ton, dodged between 2 cottonwoods, both about as big around as a coffee table, climbed out of the bullet, and looked at the Jeep tracks. I sighed and unlocked the Remington shotgun from my transmission hump, figuring if I was going hunting, I might as well go prepared.
Before closing the door, I reached in, snagged the mic from my dash, and thumbed the button. "Lucian?" The old sheriff's voice rang back. Static. "What do you need?" "I'm at the end of the rail spur, but that damn jeep of his was able to slip through and follow the goat path leading up toward the school." Static. "There was a reason those drove into Berlin and Tokyo and not a bunch of pickup trucks, you know." "Yep, but what I need is for you to keep an eye out in case he circles around on the old school road." Static. "I'm backed up to the railroad crossing in the detective's car. These assholes from the BNSF say I'm going to have to move when they hook on to that spur of yours, but when that thing starts moving, there isn't anybody going to be able to get through anyway." "Make sure you and the interceptor are on this side, would you?" Static. "Sure, I wouldn't want to miss any of the fun." I tossed the mic back inside, plucked a handheld from the side pocket, and clipped it to my belt. I closed the door, stepping into the mid-calf snow, threw the strap on the 12-gauge on my good side, and marched off after the jeep. It was getting warmer, causing the whiteout fog to thicken like pudding, and the snow in the gully was over my knees, but there was still not much wind. Luckily, I had the jeep tracks to follow, so I switched off and began walking the tire track tightrope, finally making it to a copse of naked trees and another slight depression that flattened out to the ridge where the old schoolhouse must have been. As I made the ridge, I paused to catch my breath and promised myself that if the postman made a run for it, I would just shoot him, pretty sure I was too tired to do anything else. There was a discernible shadow to the left up the hill with a smaller shadow to the right, about the size of a vehicle. I jacked around into the shotgun and continued to follow the jeep tracks, hoping that I wasn't too late, but pretty sure that if Yona Urecha was still alive, he would use her to negotiate. It was about then that I heard the unmistakable whiz of a 9mm round whipping past me into the distance. I immediately crouched, brought the Remington up, and pointed it in the direction of the report. "Rowan, you better throw down that weapon and call it quits." There was a silence for a few moments, and just in case he was a better shot than I thought, I moved to the left a little, keeping a low profile against the slope. His voice was high and nasal.
"How about we make a deal, Sheriff?"
I pinpointed his location to be in or near the jeep, so I continued to the left, figuring I could work my way along the ridge and circle around, keeping the school between us.
"I don't usually negotiate in these kinds of situations." "I've got the woman."
"I know that."
"You better stop moving out there, or all deals are off."
There was more silence, obviously more than he could stand.
"You want to hear my offer?"
I thought about letting him sweat, but I was concerned that as nervous as he was, he might shoot Yona. "I'm listening."
"What if I leave her here in the schoolhouse and you let me go back down the hill in the jeep?"
"And I'm supposed to trust you?" Against my better nature, I thought about it.
"You know I've got officers back in town, right? I know you've got an old one-legged sheriff down there, but I'd imagine that the rest of them are trying to get Richard Harvey to the emergency room or scraping the citizenry off I-90.
He had a point.
"I'll leave her in the school for you."
"Along with your gun."
"What?"
"You throw that pistol of yours out here toward me, or it's no deal. I don't mind leaving you to the..."